You're listening to the audio program Host and Guest, hosted by me, Rick Katchke. Now here's myself, Rick Katchke. No pre-recorded intro from Memphis this week. It's just episode 20 of Host and Guest. And hey, I'm your host, Rick Katchke. Today I'm joined by Tom Fuchs in part two of our extended interview. I'll have that interview with Tom in just a moment. I ran into my first grade teacher earlier today. I was by my old elementary school doing some official business for my real job, and I actually ended up encountering her. She's one of those teachers that just always had such a positive influence on my life, and I kept up with her over the years. My sisters, my younger sisters, had her as a teacher, and so I would stop by and say hello, and it was just always very nice to catch up with her. 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, one or the other, I was at the local 4th of July celebration. I was of age, ran into her, and she offered to buy me a beer. And I thought that was really cool. I don't drink beer, but I just thought that was really cool to have my first grade teacher offer to do that for me. Mrs. Lewick, you are the best. We'll have my interview with Tom Fuchs in just a moment. Tom Fuchs is a writer for Chud.com. He's a friend of mine. We talked about movies last time on the show. We're going to talk about some more this time. Here's my interview with him conducted at his residence. Hey, welcome to part two of my interview with Tom Fuchs of Chud.com. Tom, welcome back.
Hey, man, it's been a while. Good to see you.
Hey, we've got more titles from the list. Before we delve into this, anything you wanted to bring up?
I can't really think of anything. I did see 365 movies in 365 days last year.
On the last episode, you said it was 371. Well, did something happen? Or?
Retroactively eliminated six of them. I have nothing to say, honestly. I was trying to do a bit, but it didn't work.
So, for those who missed our part one, listen to it now.
You're going to be lost.
Delete this file from your computer. Go back, listen to the last episode that I did with Tom. We have a list of 20 movies from 2008. Some of them were in January 2009, which contradicts the premise of the list.
Well, no. I saw them in 2009, but they're 2008 movies.
It's too confusing. So we're going to resume with the other 10 that were not covered the last time.
And for the record, they could probably listen to this one. They're kind of interchangeable in which order you listen to them in.
I have been very precise in what films I've selected from this list. So
okay, I understand. There is a
let me run my show. I'll let you write your reviews for Chud.com. Number one, we're going to go with Rambo/Punisher Warzone.
I lumped those together because they kind of bookended the year. They're both really definitively R-rated action movies. Rambo is one of the most violent things you'll ever see. I think they're red meat movies. They're not really... They're guy movies, even though I really hesitate to use... I don't like that. That kind of sounds like guys high-fiving at Buffalo Wild Wings while watching College Hoops. But
a movie just on that.
But, you know, it must be said that Rambo does feature a scene where he shoots a man through the mouth with an arrow, and then the man falls onto a landmine and explodes. And another scene where he uses a Gatling gun at point-blank range and shoots someone in the back of the head. But it's really effective. Like, I was really impressed with Stallone's economy in his filmmaking in this one. Like I mentioned in the last podcast, so you should listen to this one second,
yeah,
or else you'll be fucking... in the woods.
That's what I was saying all along.
Gran Torino is about 40 minutes too long, 30 to 40 minutes too long. This is like 80 minutes. There's literally no way it could be too long. Like, Stallone just finishes it immediately once he's said his piece. It's really effective. I miss that method of movie making. Everything these days seems to be like at least 2 hours long, and you almost always feel like there could be 20 minutes here or there chopped from almost any movie these days.
Now, what about the other film on the opposite side of the slash?
You know, it's also extremely violent. I don't think it's nearly as economic, but I forget her name. Alexander is her last name, the director. She does a really effective job of making a fantastic B-movie. There's a scene where, you know, parkour, like the street gangs who, like, run up walls and leap over.
I do now.
Okay. Well, anyways, it's become like a big thing in movies. Like it was in the James Bond movie. There was that movie District 13, that French movie, where there's a long chase sequence. Well, in this one, there's like this crazy, I want to say Jamaican, at least the leader is Jamaican, parkour gang. And as they're doing flips in midair, Punisher blows one of them up with a missile launcher. And there's also a performance by Dominic West from The Wire.
The Wire, McNulty.
As Jigsaw, the main villain who is disfigured. He's like at the beginning of the movie, he isn't disfigured. He's pre-Jigsaw, and he's playing it with an incredibly thick ethnic accent. As broadly as possible. He's in love with his looks. You can tell this because he, like, pushes women out of the way of a mirror so he can look at himself in it.
And anyway, so he's McNulty.
His face gets mangled, and then he just goes completely batshit with his performance. And then he has a brother who eats people, who he gets out of the mental hospital. And there's a sequence where they go to a hotel, and Jigsaw is pissed off that there's windows everywhere. So his brother just starts leaping into windows and shattering them while Jigsaw laughs. And there's another scene where Jigsaw is recruiting all the different ethnic gangs to kill the Punisher. And it's like a Patton scene set in front of an American flag where he delivers an impassioned speech. It's a good movie. There's also a church set that is completely draped in neon lights. It's like a gay nightclub church. It's a lot of fun. It's not as effective or probably as good of a movie as Rambo, but I think they're equally enjoyable.
Sure. That movie, to me, sounds priceless, which brings us to the film that's on the top of the list.
The priceless. Happening.
No, priceless, Tom.
For the record, the list isn't in any specific order.
But it's at the top of the
list.
Yeah,
it is technically at the top of the list. I feel like this movie probably slipped through the cracks for a lot of people. It's a French romantic comedy. It kind of harkens back to the sophisticated sex comedies in, like, the 30s. Ernst Lubitsch is who comes to mind, who's one of my favorite director chiz. It's got Audrey, you know her last name, pronounce
Tatau.
It for me. Audrey Tatau in the lead, and Gad Elmaleh, I want to say.
Don't know his name.
Yeah, he was in The Valet, a French movie. He's going to be in Tintin, the Peter Jackson and Spielberg Tintin. So you will know him at one point. But it's a really, really fantastically directed. There's a really deft touch. There's some really fantastic information being conveyed cinematically. A lot of the comedies these days are like, especially the sex comedies, are like guy jizzes on his dog. And then the dog runs out into the family room and his parents are there with friends. You know what I'm talking
about.
That
sounds more like the end of Happiness.
That's actually a scene from Witless Protection, for the record. But they're like they don't treat sex as like a something gross, like and a joke. They treat it classily, and it's very superbly directed. The performances are excellent. I'd highly recommend it. It's a perfect date movie, but other than that, it's one of the best movies that came out last year, even beyond that. And no dogs are jizzed on.
Now, let's
or go punched in the face by Batman.
Let's go to another romantic comedy, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
I'm going to piss you off. Again, this is a movie I did not see in 2008. I saw it this year when I was trying to catch up.
You know, you've already disappointed me. You can't go any lower.
It's directed by Peter Sellette, not to be confused with the...
musician?
Not the musician Peter Sellette, who's in all of the David Wayne...
Previous guest. Walter yeah.
Movies.
Previous guest. They were on the show, Tom.
I don't know if you're familiar with them. They are Stella, I think is the name of their comedy group.
Yeah, they were on the show back in...
oh, really?
December, yeah.
How'd that go?
Oh, you should listen to it.
I'm sure it's great. Anyways, Peter Sellette, he made Raising Victor Vargas as his first movie, which is amazing. It's a really tender portrait of two teenagers kind of having their first relationship. And it's just like, it feels like there's a lot of realism in that movie where you feel like you're invading their privacy almost at sometimes. It's that rich. So I was expecting something good out of this, and I wasn't disappointed. I mean, it's not nearly as high a caliber as Raising Victor Vargas. But there's still that sort of lightness of touch in the interplay between Kat Dennings and Michael Cera's characters in the movie. He really captures New York City in a way that a lot of movies don't. You know, like most movies will just generically be like Times Square, and,
right.
And that's New York. Sellette goes a lot further than that. There's some broad moments, but their friend, she has a... And I feel bad for forgetting the actress's name. I want to say Ari Gaynor?
She does listen to the show.
So. I apologize. But she does a really good job as Kat Dennings' best friend in the movie, who is progressively more drunk as the night goes through. It's a pretty thankless performance. Like, you're just looking like an idiot for the majority of the movie. But she really excels at doing it. And there's also a couple of nice cameos. You get Andy Samberg as a hobo. You get, what's his name? That guy.
Oh, he listens to this show.
So. I apologize, Brad Pitt.
Is he in the movie?
No, he's not in the movie.
Why would you apologize to him then?
Because I thought Curious Case wasn't very good.
I think this is time to move on to another film on the list.
We've hit a speed bump.
Let's go to, is it In Bruges? Is that...
Yes, In Bruges.
Nailed it.
Congratulations. You did one better than my Tatao. I had to ask for a lifeline on that one. This movie is fantastic.
We're not talking Slumdog.
No, we're not. Really good, this movie. The first feature film by Martin McDonagh. He was a playwright, and he made a short film that won an Oscar starring Brendan Gleeson. This movie got nominated, and I thought that was one of the great notices on the Oscars' part, noticing something that might have slipped through the cracks otherwise. They nominated this for Best Original Screenplay. It really pinballs between comedy, drama, action, and then there's like a definite sadness to the movie. And sometimes it's not perfect. The kind of Bruges as a purgatory thing is a little heavy-handed at a lot of points, but like once Ralph Fiennes shows up as like their boss, who they're hitmen in the movie, who have been sent to Bruges to hide after a hit went terribly wrong. Once Fiennes shows up, it kind of goes to an entirely different level of insanity. But there's like the characters are all fleshed out. Nobody's playing a caricature. They're all given details that really resonate with you and don't allow them to be used only as jokes. And a dwarf is karate chopped in the neck. Which I feel is at least right below punching a dog in the face.
Yeah.
In terms of things that your fan base is going to want to see. Things that arouse me.
Now let's go to Speed Racer.
I'm a little pissed off that so many people put this on their worst movies of 2008 list. I don't understand that at all. I feel like it's a fantastic family movie. I think it has a good message. It might be slightly overlong. It didn't feel that way when I've watched it.
Not long enough. I loved it.
I'm glad you did. I mean, it's just a blast, and it's a filming style. They're basically taking the anime editing style and using it in a live-action movie, which hasn't really been seen before in live-action. A lot of people have been calling it like a... And these are like, you know, the advocates for the movie are saying, like, this movie is going to change cinema. I don't think so, since this was already editing techniques that were used in anime, clearly. So it's not like they invented this editing out of thin air. But I thought that the way that they made the movie was excellent. A lot of people, I think, thought the action was incoherent. I didn't have a problem with that, but I think maybe we're part of an ADD generation that maybe a lot of the critics aren't. So it might have been a little too fast. I was going to say flashy.
Fast and flashy.
A little too fast little and too flashy.
Fast
for
and flashy. Too fast, too flashy. April.
I feel the movie got an unfair shake. I mean, there's no dwarves karate chopped, but there are ninjas, and it's got John Goodman.
I was the type of person who was sort of laughing about it, and then you said, no, Rick, it's really good. Don't laugh about it. And I went and I saw it, and I laughed, but I was laughing because the movie entertained me. And it's a good film.
It's a beautiful story. I appreciate you adding that little personal flavor.
That's what I do. I connect. Now let's go to the next item on the list, Wanted/Hancock.
Sure. This is kind of the flip side of the Iron Man Dark Knight, which was on the previous podcast. These are two really poor examples of superhero comic books being turned into movies. I think Wanted kind of got a pass because its visuals are really flashy, but there's some interesting things being done, but I didn't find any of the action sequences kinetic or entertaining or they're as incoherent as Speed Racer. So I don't understand why people felt like this movie was superior in any way. Plus, James McAvoy plays like the biggest prick of a main character that you're supposed to feel sympathy for that I saw in all of 2008.
Neil LaBute wrote this, right?
Yeah, James McAvoy just punches women in the face, and then...
And then hits dogs, too.
Just kills some dogs, kicks a dwarf in the chest off a cliff. But no, he, like, at the beginning of the movie, you're supposed to feel sympathy for him because he's kind of weak-willed. He doesn't take control of his own life. But he's, like, a misogynistic prick at that point. And at the end of the movie, he's the same douchebag that he was at the beginning, but now he can kill people really well. I mean, Morgan Freeman's head explodes in the movie. That's about all it has going for it. Angelina Jolie shoots herself in the head, too, with one of those curved bullets. It's a really stupid sequence. I'm going to spoil the movie because I think it's terrible and I don't want anyone to see it. James McAvoy is cornered by all these assassins who stand around him in a circle. And then she does the curved bullet thing, so it goes through everyone's head. And then she stands in place, so it kills her, too. It's laughable. It is laughable.
And it's deserving of that sort of laugh. Which sounded terrible.
It's not very good. I mean, I didn't hate it while I was watching it, but it's the type of movie that the more you think about it, you're like, this movie is just terrible, and it has nothing good to say or interesting to say. Unless the director hates America, in which case I could see there being a take on it where this is him calling America out on being a piece of shit.
Now, let's look at the companion here, which is Hancock.
You know, I kind of had high hopes for this movie. I like Peter Berg as a director. I thought The Kingdom was nice. It's a little slight. It kind of is just a movie that builds to one action sequence at the end. But Will Smith and Jason Bateman, to me, was a pretty cool pairing for a summer blockbuster. And this was a script that's been floating around for years trying to be made into a movie. And there's a reason why, clearly, because this movie was garbage. It starts off really well. It's kind of going for that, what would a superhero be like in real life?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they'd probably be the only person like them, and they'd probably be saddled with some depression issues. So Will Smith plays a drunk, and he's charming. He's Will Smith. I mean, he's playing one of the more surly characters he's played recently, but it's effective. It's about him, learning to connect, and then Jason Bateman is the PR guy who he saves, who's trying to rehabilitate his image. But then it just goes bonkers at that point, and then becomes a movie. And I'm going to spoil it again. And I mean, I apologize to your listeners. You might want to put a warning at the beginning.
I will. I'll put several
because I
throughout the episode.
This movie was just really turned into fucking shit. Charlize Theron also has superpowers, it's revealed. And they're gods, I guess. And then the movie just starts making up rules on the fly. They're, like, both in the hospital. And as Hancock gets beaten up by a gangster, they lose powers the closer they are to each other. They make this up about near the end of the movie. And then while they're in the hospital, as Will Smith is getting beaten up by people, she's feeling it for some reason. Like, when he's hit, she feels it.
Isn't that the premise of a Cheech and Chong movie?
I think it's the premise of Freaky Friday, actually.
That they feel the pain, too?
No, I don't think so. They're not twins in Freaky Friday, are they?
No.
No. And anyways, it ends with Will Smith carving something into the moon, like Jason Bateman's PR idea. He carves it into the moon, and then he's like, look up at the moon. And then Jason Bateman's like, uh-oh, how are we going to explain this one? And then Will Smith jumps off a roof and flies away with an eagle. He inexplicably has an eagle on his shoulder on the roof. And then, like, Jason Bateman and his wife reconnect, but she's immortal, and this doesn't seem to be an issue with them, that she will never die, and her child and Jason Bateman will both die long before, well...
She never will.
Yeah, never will die. But this doesn't seem to be an issue with any of the characters in the movie, because once Will Smith leaves, he goes to the other coast, so they're not near each other, so they don't feel pain anymore. They're just laughing, and they're, like, at a carnival.
Okay.
They're making a sequel, by the way, to Hancock.
Thank goodness.
And I couldn't be more pleased.
Let's go to Let the Right One In. I, for some reason, thought that this was the Rolling Stones concert film, which is, like, what, let the light shine?
Shine a light?
Shine a light.
Shine a light.
None of the words that are in Let the Right One In.
There's one word that rhymes, to be fair, in your defense. Let the Right One In is a Swedish vampire movie. I mean, that's kind of being really reductive about it, but it's really one of the finest movies that was released last year. It's right at the... It would be in my top five if I were to do such a thing, which I'm not doing here.
Right.
So forget... Nix that last statement. I apologize.
It's a really beautiful portrayal of a relationship between a prepubescent boy and a girl who doesn't have to wear clothes in the cold and is generally slowly but surely revealed to be a vampire. I mean, it's no big secret. You kind of are figuring something's different mm-hmm. about her from the start. But it kind of really captures the emotions of being that age, like on the cusp of puberty and like the confusion in relationships there. It has the most righteous scene, like the most like fuck yeah violent scene in a movie this year where you're waiting for it to happen and you're so glad it does. And the shot composition by the director is really remarkable. A lot of, they look like paintings, a lot of them. There's some shots. There's a dog. There's a really good use of a dog in this one. Doesn't get punched in the face. It's one of the shots. He uses the entire frame, and there's this kind of oppressive, dreary quality to Sweden that he captures with the movie.
Now let's move on to The Happening.
I'd call it the worst movie of the year, but I can't really say that because I enjoyed it about as thoroughly as anything I saw all year. There's this rare thing that doesn't happen very often with movies where it's so bad that it boomerangs and becomes good by virtue of being so wrong-headed in every aspect.
Right.
And this usually can't happen. Like, Witless Protection, this couldn't happen. Like, the best Witless Protection could hope for was some of the supporting actors might chip in and make it less of a piece of shit. But this is special because Shyamalan is a good director. I think he's completely lost touch with humanity, as this script attests to, because these people do not talk to each other like human beings talk to one another. But he's still a good visual director. I think he's shown that until this movie, where the directing is bad. Like, there's close-ups where there shouldn't be close-ups. And it's just, it's so, like, it's hard to describe just how bad this movie is.
I would recommend it to everyone. It's really entertaining.
I'd put it right there with Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2 as the best bad movies ever made. I mean, he really completely lets down all the performers in the movie. Like, Zooey Deschanel seems like she's mentally retarded throughout the movie. And that's clearly the direction he's giving her. He didn't dissuade her from performing that way. And Wahlberg is basically playing, his voice sounds exactly like Andy Samberg's impression of Mark Wahlberg in the movie. And all of his sentences seem to end in a question mark. There's just so many sequences, it's hard to really pin down. But there's literally, it's a roller coaster of great shit.
And this one, end. You don't want to spoil.
No, I really don't want to spoil. I mean, it's great. Wahlberg is terrible in it. Never been worse. Same for Deschanel.
What about Leguizamo?
Leguizamo, never been worse either, and this is counting The Pest and Spawn.
And Sex Freak.
Didn't see it.
It's his one-man show.
I didn't know. Is it a film?
It was on HBO.
All right, fair enough. Ruck. Alan Ruck is the only person who comes out of The Happening unscathed. He's in it for 10 seconds. He says, I think there's an event happening, and he's gone. So it's too, you can't fuck that up.
He is not wearing a Gordie Howe jersey, though, so...
And then he backs out of the auditorium in a car and falls off a cliff. Just a really weird, tonally odd shout-out at that point. I really don't want to spoil anything, but at the same time I do. I highly recommend seeing the movie. It's really one of the most fantastically horrible things that has ever been made.
Now let's go to some of your favorite comedies of the year, Pineapple Express / Role Models.
I paired these together because I feel that they're both an example of a sort of idiosyncratic voice. I mean, David Wayne for Role Models.
You know, he was on the show.
David Wayne?
David Wayne, yeah. Back in December.
How'd that go?
It went well. You should listen to it.
I'll give it a listen sometime. But David Wayne for Role Models, David Gordon Green for Pineapple Express. They're kind of singular. They have singular visions. In David Wayne's case, he doesn't have like so much a visual language as clearly established as David Gordon Green, but he has certainly a sensibility that shines through in all of his work. And I thought he really effectively melded that together with a mainstream piece of work like this. Mm-hmm. It shines through. I mean, the movie does follow a sort of generic plot line. You know where it's heading, but that doesn't stop it from being extremely entertaining. You have some really good performances, Paul Rudd, Bobby J. Thompson. But there's the, like, 80 Miles character, Joe Latruglio. They just come in and they kill it, and they do bits that you wouldn't normally get out of, like, Adam Shankman directing Role Models. Then it would just be Sean William Scott getting, like, hit in the balls, and then coming on a dog, and then it walking into a family room while there's a fancy dinner party. Pineapple Express is actually my favorite movie of the year. I don't know if it's the best made movie of the year, but it was my favorite. I think it's kind of a sublime pairing of David Gordon Green. It's like very, to its core, a David Gordon Green movie, like the nature montages and just the way that scenes play out. They don't play out the way that a comedy would normally play out.
Right.
Some scenes will peter out instead of like ending on a high note, which makes them funnier, even though in a lot of cases that wouldn't be the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the movie is hysterical when it's just Franco and Rogan playing off each other, but then they introduce Danny McBride and the thing just goes to an entirely new level at that point, and then it becomes like a batshit insane action movie at that point. There's so much great character work. Like, I'd love to follow just about any character in that movie, like even Ed Begley Jr. I'd love to watch like a short film based on his dad character in that movie. I love that movie, and I think it's just a great pairing of a director who you normally wouldn't expect to be directing. Like,
this is the only time he's ever done a comedy.
Yeah, although his short films that he made before, like George Washington, mm-hmm. did show that he had, you know, he was acclimated to doing something like this.
He made those at the North Carolina School of the Arts, and they rejected me from attending their university.
And you know, Danny McBride went there too.
Yes, I do.
It's a shame.
Now you've said your favorite film, so I feel like
this is a little anticlimactic.
Anticlimactic, but it's what we're gonna do to this list. It's Burn After Reading.
I feel like maybe this movie doesn't get enough love, and it might be the type of thing where it's a grower, like a lot of Coen Brothers movies. It's like a tumor. It grows.
Doctors now call them growers, for the record.
It sounds a little better.
It's okay, my grower is benign.
But it's the type of movie where the more you watch it, the more clear what they're doing becomes. They've just gotten better and better as filmmakers, I feel. Like, they're conveying so much information simply, like, through their shots, which I think is one of the reasons cinema exists, is to visually convey information. I mean, the dialogue is icing on the cake, but they're really on top of their game at this point. There's, like, scenes, like, you can tell they're moving higher up the chain in the CIA because the floors become nicer and more carpeted. And then George Clooney's character is obsessed with flooring throughout, so you can tell that he's kind of crawling for higher position. I mean, the characters are, they're unlikable, I'd say, for the most part. Sometimes they're ciphers. Like, they don't really have a lot of attributes. Brad Pitt is hilarious in the movie, but it would be hard. You'd be hard-pressed to describe the character, other than kind of an asexual moron. All the performances are, you know, tip-top of the game. I think it's a hilarious, it's playing on the conventions of the spy movie, where everybody feels they have knowledge, but it's pretty much only about relationships between people and their sex lives, instead of these, like, government secrets that everyone feels they have. Just about every performance, I feel, is A+. Richard Jenkins, who, it should be said, had an amazing year. The Visitor was a great movie. Not on this list, but...
It wasn't that great of a movie.
It was. I mean, this isn't, like I said, this isn't the best movies of the year. He's great in that movie. He's in Step Brothers, where he does an anecdote about how he wishes he was a dinosaur when he was a kid, which is fantastic. I mean, Brad Pitt, everyone points him out as being kind of the high point of this movie, but I feel Clooney's work is maybe overlooked. His parting scene in the movie just kills me, and I've watched that scene at least like 3 or 4 times, and his reactions are just spectacular. I feel like we're petering out here.
Hey, before we totally peter out, let's get to our recommendations. First of all, film recommendation.
Okay, I'll go with what is probably, if not my favorite movie, at least right near the top. So one of my favorite movies of all time is Ball of Fire. It's a Howard Hawks movie. It's a Billy Wilder and I forget his first name, screenplay. And it's Gary Cooper and Barbara Stanwyck. It's kind of a play on Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. It's just an excellent screwball comedy. Barbara Stanwyck and Gary Cooper have amazing chemistry in it. There's all the great character actors from that era as the professors that Gary Cooper works with, who are like the Seven Dwarves.
Okay.
Spectacular movie.
All right. And now, finally, an album recommendation.
Sure. There's an album I read about. I don't remember the blog that I read about it on, but I picked it up based on the recommendation there. It's called Steppin' Out, Fred Astaire Sings. And it's Fred Astaire doing old standards from his catalog of songs that he sang in movies with a jazz band accompanying it. You can tell he's older. His voice is a little maybe weaker than it used to be. But it's kind of just really great, easy listening. And it just proves how really fucking cool Fred Astaire is that he could just walk in on the day and nail all these songs with a jazz band.
Anything that you want to say to wrap the show up, Tom?
I could, do you want another film recommendation?
No.
How about House 2?
All right, well, Tom, thank you so much for being a guest on Host and Guest.
No problem, I can't wait to come back for part 3.
Thanks again for joining me on the show, Tom Fuchs. I'd also like to thank Fawn Simpson for helping produce the program this time around, and also for creating the logo that is on your computer screen right now. Tiny Folk does the theme song. You know where to check them out, CLLCT.com. Tell your friends about the podcast, Host and Guest, the very show you're listening to. I'm your host, Rick Katchke, and this has been episode 20 of Host and Guest. Yes.